So, would you rather contend with Ghost Dog or Ghost Dad?
Well, I don't know, because Ghost Dog is a badass, super awesome samurai, surrounded by talented rappers,
True.
and Ghost Dad is likely to serve you a drink and then do something to you in your sleep.
These jokes are the most topical that we have made.
This is Junk Food Cinema.
Hi, this is Dick Miller. You're listening to Junk Food Cinema on Film School Rejects. Who are these guys?
Everybody, welcome to a rather spooky episode of Junk Food Cinema here on FilmSchoolRejects.com. This is the weekly cult and exploitation film cast that is so good, it just has to be fattening. I am your host, Brian Salisbury, and I've actually seen all of the five movies before Leonard Part 6. And I am joined by my...
Oh, yeah? Well, go ahead. Introduce
joined
me.
By my friend and co-host, novelist slash screenwriter, C. Robert Cargill, who has something very important to tell you.
Who has seen all nine of the movies before Malcolm X.
Oh, well done. Well done. I like when they switch from numerals to Roman numerals about part five. It was good. Well, just to let you know, wisdom like that can be... And be found on
iTunes.
You didn't
see that coming, did you?
I didn't. That was really well done. We're on iTunes and Stitcher, in case you want more of that. You can also follow us on Twitter, at Junk Food Cinema, or like the podcast on Facebook, facebook.com/junkfoodcinema. And if I sound like I'm rushing, it's only because this week, as we continue through our exploration of modern junk food masters...
We gotta power through a lot of movies, so we're drinking a lot of coffee, we're talking really fast, we're gonna go through all these movies without taking breath.
And meth is a hell of a drug. This week's honoree is someone who, yes, you've probably heard of, but we're going to talk about the overall arc of this guy's career that is really surprising and has some things in it that we know you might have missed.
Yeah, and it's an interesting arc, too, because it's a guy, this week we're talking about somebody who's been well-known on the indie horror scene for years. Everybody knows him. Everybody loves him. He's apparently one of the sweetest, nicest guys on the planet. But he just has a brutal imagination and has been trying desperately to get Hollywood's attention to let him make big, enjoyable action slick Hollywood movies. He's wanted to make Michael Bay movies without being Michael Bay, and just has had lots of things go wrong, has stumbled in a couple of places, and almost got pigeonholed, and has been trying to make a real go of it. And there were times in his career where he was on the ropes, where it was like, oh no, that dude's done. And we're gonna talk about all of that today, about Mr. James Wan.
And it's so satisfying that we're talking about somebody who has reached the top of the mountain and achieved that goal that he's had. And we've been lucky enough to watch as all of the cobblestones in that road have been placed, and that's what we're going to talk about. We're going to talk about how James Wan finally got to direct Furious 7 and all of the genre films that he's been making that has made him a modern junk food master, kind of quietly under the radar. And I remember when he got hired to direct Furious 7, when the announcement came out, people were like, they balked at the idea of a horror guy taking over the biggest action franchise on the planet. But know this, guys. The evidence of his aptness for that gig is present in the movie Saw, which is his first big film. 2004, he directs it with Lee Whannell.
It's his first film, isn't it?
Is it his first overall? I guess it's his first.
I think Saw is, that was
his
their...
His very first
yeah.
film. Okay. This is James Wan, by the way, from Australia, makes a movie called Saw in 2004. And everything you need to know about why he will someday direct Furious 7 is in that, and I want you to think about that as we go through the rest of this, because we'll come back around to it, so just keep Saw in the back of your mind. But as everyone has seen Saw, and we could talk for days about it, but you already know everything we're going to say, Let's move on to a film. What should be the first? I'm gonna let you pick where we go from here, Cargill. You downshift and change lanes for us.
Well, I want to talk. Let's talk about, because we're talking about his next two films, which both came out in 2007. Correct?
We are. Yes.
And let's go with Dead Silence.
Beware the stare of Mary Shaw. She had no children, only dogs.
Destroy the dogs!
And if you see her, do not scream. She'll rip your tongue out at the seam.
Because that's the next step in his career, and it's also very interesting because Dead Silence is a film I'm not a big fan of. I don't think it works overall. I know that some horror fans really love it. But what's interesting about Dead Silence is that in this one film, you find so many elements in a movie that doesn't work that James Wan and his writing partner Lee Whannell would then go on to pilfer from themselves and go, well, yeah, it didn't work in that movie, but nobody saw Dead Silence. Mm-hmm. So let's do it again. And then would do it again in movies that would get it right. There are so many gags in this movie. There's so many visuals in this movie. There's so many flourishes in this movie that you will then subsequently see that we will mention in all these other films, that that's what makes this film interesting to talk about. If you're a fan of James Wan at all, you owe it to yourself to go back and rewatch this film, not for the entertainment value, because it's uneven as fuck.
Well, and here's why that's important to watch and note Dead Silence. I actually think Dead Silence is a lot of fun. I mean, yes, I don't disagree with you. It has its problems, but I really enjoy the hell out of the ride that it takes you on.
The interesting thing about this film is, as far as horror films go, it is far more original in its structure than most horror films are, especially most horror films of this type.
Very true.
It's a movie in which the opening stinger, you know, the cold open, is actually involves our protagonist, and our death in the first 10 minutes of the movie is the wife of the protagonist, and that sends him back to his hometown where he's following around a mystery. So it's more like a detective story.
Yes, because the mystery doesn't start in the hometown.
No.
In most stories like this, the structure is somebody we don't know who they are, they're not central to the plot, gets killed in the hometown, bringing a long a long estranged character from that town back to that town. This is like, no, we're going to kill your wife in your house, and then you're going to have to make the decision to go back there to figure out what happened.
And you're going to go back and bury your wife there and then investigate. Mm-hmm. And it is a weird, fucked up little narrative that way. That element is interesting.
But what I was getting at, the reason it's important to watch and note this movie, is James Wan's handle on Twitter is Creepy Puppet. He loves creepy puppets. He had one in Saw. This is his official creepy puppet movie. And then we see, as Cargill said, how those specific elements would go on to be the backbone of movies like The Conjuring and then The Conjuring spinoff, which he didn't have anything to do with, but still.
Yeah, you see, you know, the doll, and let's talk about the various influences that we'll see here. Mm-hmm. You know, the dolls, the dolls thing is a thing that carries over, you know, with Annabelle, mm-hmm. Which then his biggest horror movie to date. The villain in this is this, you know, creepy old woman ghost spirit, which again looks almost identical to the main baddie in Insidious and Insidious 2. Then you see just a number of just small little bits, small little gags, like little scares, if you will, that, will then show up in the other films. And you're like, oh, I remember this moment from this movie. And oh, this moment, it really is kind of weird. It's like, it's almost like James Wan made a movie of James Wan's greatest hits all put into a movie, but he did it at the beginning of his career. Yeah. And it's such a strange thing to watch. It's just like, it's almost like, you know, it's something I know a lot of writers that do this, that, you know, there's a great old, adage, that's attributed to Ray Bradbury. But nobody's quite sure if he actually said it or not, that if you want to become a writer, sit down and write your first novel, then go into your backyard, dig a hole, bury that novel, and, then go back inside and write your first novel. And I feel like Dead Silence is like that as a film, where he just, it's the manuscript in the drawer that he keeps stealing ideas from and keeps going back to that well, because it's like, well, nobody remembers that, because it was a movie that didn't do well. It was a disappointment at the time. Everybody's like, oh, the director of Saw, because Saw was such a big, huge explosion on the scene and then led to a ton of sequels, to where they dominated every Halloween. Was a Saw movie, and so when this movie hit, it just didn't catch on the same way, and so he keeps going back to that. But you seriously, if you want to examine the career of James Wan, this is the place to start.
Absolutely, absolutely. So you watch Dead Silence. One of the things that we're gonna there's gonna be several points throughout the continuum that this happens. You will see the puppet from Saw make an appearance in Dead Silence. It's one of the scenes where you see a lot of puppets at once. And then you also see Edgar Bergen, which was Charlie McCarthy's puppet.
Yep.
So, like, again, like, puppets, big deal for James Wan. And in
there's a number. If you look online, there's a number of different references in those shots to specific puppets.
Which is, again, in a very fun movie. The execution, not always there, but just a movie that, again, like Cargill said, sows the seeds for a lot of things that would work for Wan later on. And that brings us to the other film from 2007.
Hell yes.
The one we're probably going to spend the most time talking about.
The one that,
frankly,
I've been telling you for a while that you need to see.
And I've always wanted to, because something I knew about this movie that I know I had that you didn't know was that...
Sure, rub it in.
Yeah, I'm going to. Because it doesn't happen very often. But Death Sentence is based on a book by the guy who wrote Death Wish. And which is a guy named
Brian Garfield.
And it was the
sequel, right?
It was the direct sequel. And so the book has to do with the exact same character from Death Wish. So ostensibly, Death Sentence takes place in the same universe as the Death Wish movies, except that they've changed the name and the kind of the story background of their central character. This movie centers around Kevin Bacon, who is an executive doing very well, a very loving family man. The opening sequence is a number of home videos strung together where they show you... They basically establish the fuck out of the fact that he loves his family and that they spend all this time together, they do everything together. Something tragic happens, his eldest son gets murdered, and it becomes a Death Wish movie. It becomes a movie about a guy who the justice system has failed, who has decided to take things into his own hands. The difference between Death Sentence and a Death Wish movie is that it is not clean cut. It is not a situation where once he starts getting revenge, everything falls into place. There are dire, dire consequences for his vigilantism.
Oh, it's messy as fuck in terms of what happens to him, deliberately so. And it's an interesting story narrative. I mean, it's really interesting because, I was sitting and watching it with my wife who had never seen it. And, the setup of the movie is, you know, guy loves his family. He's the perfect family man. You know, they set this all up. He's taking his son back from a hockey game where he's, you know, the MVP. All is great. They stop at a skeevy little gas station. They go in. Whole bunch of thugs roll up in masks and kill the gas station attendant and then slit the throat of the son. And while this guy is there, forced to watch his son get murdered, then they take off, and he ends up catching one of them before they take off. You know, getting the mask off, beating the crap out of the guy who killed his son, and then. All this shit starts happening. He realizes the cops don't want to go all out, don't want to put this guy away for life. The DA doesn't want to put this guy away for life. Well, they want a deal.
But here's what's more interesting about what happens is that it's not that this guy has any, like, his affiliation with the gang is really what the problem is. It's the fact that the lawyer prosecuting knows that with just one eyewitness, the case is not going to be a slam dunk.
So,
which is a really interesting turn from most courtroom dramas.
Yeah.
Where it's like that one eyewitness can sink somebody.
Yeah. And so
which is actually more true to life. But anyway.
So what this guy does is he then sinks the own case. The criminal gets let out and he goes to get revenge. And by 30 minutes into the movie, he's actually successfully killed the guy who killed his son.
Yeah.
And at that point I pause the movie and I go, there you go. Death Sentence. Shortest revenge movie ever. And my wife is just like, all right, what the fuck happens
more
now?
More of a death clause than a death sentence. Yeah, it's very short.
Yeah, it's a death preposition. because this movie...
You never end the movie on a preposition.
Never end on a preposition. So this is one of those movies that's a lot like... Hard Times, which we talked about a couple weeks ago.
Interesting.
A couple months ago, in which you reach that point in the movie, you're like, oh, well, shit, this is, you got the guy who killed his son. What happens now? Mm-hmm. And what happens now is the vigilante who went out for justice was fucking sloppy as shit because he was a fucking guy from the suburbs. And the criminals know exactly who he is and go to get revenge on him. Mm-hmm. And it becomes, you know,
an eye for an eye for an eye for an eye.
It becomes a war of attrition.
Yes.
Where
everyone thinks they're right in a war, which is a great line from this movie.
Yeah. And it is a war of attrition in which things get increasingly more and more fucked up, in which the second act isn't about him going and getting revenge and picking these guys off one by one, because it's set up that it could be that. It's this great concept where, you know, it's like the guy who killed his son was doing it because he was being pressured by the rest of the gang in an initiation. And it's like, well, these guys all played a part of it, so they all deserve to die. No. He kills the guy. He feels really shitty about it. It doesn't balance the equation, as he says. He's, you know, he's kind of fucked up. And then these people figure out who the fuck he is. And then it's like, oh, shit. Now the second act is these guys fucking with him and trying to kill him for killing their guy.
Yeah.
And then it increasingly ramping up until everything gets fucked up in the end of the second act. And it's literally cost him his family.
Mm-hmm.
And he's beaten to fuck. And that's where this movie goes from being really interesting but uneven into 20 minutes of pure cinema bliss.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. And this is the thing, too. This is the movie. This is... I'm sure when James Wan got this movie, people were like, oh, didn't he do Saw and like that puppet movie? I don't know. He's doing an action movie now. And he brings, in a beautiful way, this hybrid of horror action. Because you can tell in those action sequences that it's a horror guy doing them. Because people don't just get shot and fall over. Fingers fly off and, like, legs come apart at the knees. Like, it is brutal and honest with its violence in a way that you would normally see played for thrills and happy, and satisfaction in a horror film.
Keep in mind that this is during what is, you know, sadly called the torture porn era.
That's true.
Which Saw heavily played into, which Eli Roth gets all the crap for, and Saw gets mentioned as part of it. When really the torture porn era kind of originates from Saw. And
I don't know if I agree with that, but I understand what you're saying.
But I don't like to. The term torture porn,
no,
but
it's
unfortunately it's the only term that people have that they associate with it. But you've got a torture porn director coming in and doing the end of Taxi Driver.
Yes.
And it is just because at this point, there comes a point where, you know, his family is dead. He is beaten to fuck. The cops are after him because they know that he murdered one of these people, and they know that he started this war. They know that things are dangerous because of him. He slips away. He is broken. He is lost. He has a scar up his, he's got a wound up his head from having gone off a second story balcony. And he shaves his fucking head and doesn't even get all the hair, and he doesn't fucking care.
Oh, he looks deranged.
That is how few fucks this guy has to give. There is a moment where you just know. You know what happens, where everything is fucked, and I call it the angel of death moment, where Kevin Bacon, who is the star of this movie, is looking down. He's sad. He's just given this speech, and then he just slowly looks up and out, and just you see the hate in his fucking eyes. And from that moment on, he is not that dude anymore that you've been watching in the rest of the movie. He is a guy who knows he is going to die and is going to kill every motherfucker that gets in his way. And that movie from that point on gets brutal as fuck.
This reminds me so much more of like Rolling Thunder than it does a traditional Death Wish sequel.
Yeah.
And it's so fucking good. And the other thing that's interesting is, in terms of James Wan bringing horror influence into an action film, think about the reason his son was killed in the very first place. It had nothing to do with the robbery. It was an initiation.
Yeah.
And how did they start interacting with his gang? The gang was driving down the street without their lights on. He flashed, it's a gang high beam initiation. It is a contemporary retelling of the urban legend of the gang high beam initiation.
Yeah.
this is fucking horror from the get-go.
Yeah.
And I love what James Wan does with that, and it makes it so entertaining on both levels. Not to mention, he's got a great cast to work with Kevin Bacon, John Goodman, Kelly Preston, Aisha Tyler, and possibly the only good Garrett Hedlund performance.
Well, you know, and here's an interesting thing about casting. This movie has one of the most racially diverse casts I've ever seen. It's a cast in which they're the only white characters in the movie that have lines that aren't the fucking villains is the family. And one of the family is clearly a villain. Everyone else, every other supporting character, is of a varying ethnicity. Like, James Wan got in there and had his chance with a real budget and fucking just started, hiring a really diverse cast.
Which may come from the fact that that James Wan is from Malaysia and grew up in Australia.
Yes.
I mean, the guy is like a living symbol of diversity.
Who now lives in Los Angeles.
Lives in Los Angeles, exactly.
Yeah, so, but this cast is made. John Goodman, holy shit. First of all, let's talk about John Goodman. You guys already probably love John Goodman. This is one of the single greatest John Goodman performances ever. It is. He's in three scenes of the movie, and all of them are fucking amazing. He is chewing up the scenery in the best way. It's literally one of those roles where I guarantee you he wanted John Goodman, and they got him for just a day, or maybe a day and a half. They barely had him for anything, but he, every moment he's on screen is fucking magical. He plays this crime lord and the father of the main villain in the movie, and it's so fucking good. He's so good. And
and the speech he gives about that.
Oh yeah.
Oh my god.
Oh, every speech. The moment when he and Kevin Bacon are in the same room together is just like, at the end, my wife just paused the movie and just looked over and said, "That might be one of the most fucked up moments you have ever shown me."
Yeah.
Because it's just the soul of what that is, uh-huh. is just, and the dialogue in that, like, that's the thing about this movie. And let me for a moment talk about the thankless job that Kelly Preston does. Because the problem with this movie, the reason why this movie is as low ranked as it is amongst, you know, fans, and why it didn't go very far, was because everything that doesn't work in this movie is the family stuff. It's overly maudlin, and I think the film's biggest crippling factor is its music choices. Its music choices just do not work. This is a gritty, descent into hell kind of movie that keep singing in the heavy scenes, and he is crying.
I will tell you what that felt like to me. That felt, because it was choral, is what it was. It was a choir, and I felt like if you think about where James Wan started making films in horror, usually choirs are used for a completely different purpose.
Yes,
and this was a more upbeat choir trying to achieve a different emotional reaction,
it's
and
so
it doesn't
maudlin.
Work. But
it's
if you would
so
take
maudlin.
If you had taken that choir and put it in a horror movie, we would be talking. Yeah. We'd be having a completely different discussion.
Yeah, and the thing is this is one of those movies where all the stuff that takes place in his office is just kind of milquetoast, and all the stuff at home is just kind of sappy. And Kelly Preston nails every beat of this movie.
Yeah,
she's always you're getting these great performances out of these characters that unfortunately just the James Wan wasn't zeroed in on the family elements of this film. It felt like he was overdoing it to oversell the motivation of why this guy descends into hell, and those sequences just don't work as well and sometimes come across as pretty bad. But every single moment with a criminal, every single moment with Kevin Bacon fighting these guys is fucking amazing. And so ultimately the film becomes kind of a wash where it's, mm-hmm. you know, as much as amazing, there is stuff that doesn't work. And so people kind of wrote it off. But since the last 20 minutes is nothing but, once you get into those last 20 minutes, it's like, holy God. And the final moments of the villain in this movie is one of my favorite final moments of the villain in any movie. This is why I could not wait for you to watch this movie, Brian.
Oh my God, I loved it so much.
That movie, there's this, you know, there's that scene where he's just like, you look like us now. Look what I turned you into. I made you, you know, that it's that whole kind of villain thing. And you just have Kevin Bacon kind of pull out the gun and put it on his lap and just look over and go, you ready? And it's just, and when he, the villain is, the reaction is just so great and so gripping. And it's just, it's one of the greatest, most satisfying bits of revenge ever after this big whole bloody thing. And then James Wan has the audacity, the brilliant audacity, to not even show us that moment because we don't need it. We already get the satisfaction. He milks the emotional satisfaction out of that scene. And it is, that's the thing that's so frustrating about this movie, is that all of that is so good, like epically good, that it's just so sad that some of the other moments in the movie just don't work as well. And because this movie, oh God, and knowing, finding out just today from you, the fact that the book that, because it said based on a book by, and so I was like, oh, I don't know which book it was based on. And it's like, oh shit, of course it's the sequel to Death Wish. Oh, and because that was my wife's one big problem with the movie. She's like, I don't understand why this guy's such a badass. Why is this guy such a badass? Why does he know how to shoot? Why does he know? It's like, oh, yeah. Why? Because
Paul Kersey.
It's Paul Kersey.
Yeah.
That's kind of a really interesting thing.
This may supplant Death Wish 3 as my favorite Death Wish sequel. I do want to, since we're talking about the road to Furious 7, there's a couple things I want to mention. First of all, the gang in this show up in their own signature, like, street racers.
Oh, fuck yes.
Flag. And then
that look like they're out of Fast and Furious.
Not only that, but did you notice, you've seen Furious 7 now, so did you notice that the kill where he's fighting with the guy in the car and it's rolling backwards, the way he gets out of that car and jumps off as it's falling? Very similar to the bus stunt with Paul Walker in Furious 7.
Are you suggesting that perhaps that James Wan borrows from himself every once in a while?
I am suggesting that, and I'm suggesting that we should have known from day one that he was the right choice for Furious 7. That's
I'm
trying to get.
I knew. I mean, that was what, when I...
You're the smartest guy in the room. Congratulations.
I'm not. Well, that we knew that before this podcast started.
You knew that
however,
before this podcast.
However, no, once I heard, I was really happy when I heard that because I don't know James Wan. I've never met him.
He's a great guy.
The everyone that I know that's been friends with him for 10 years out in Hollywood all say the exact same thing. Mm-hmm. He's a guy they love going over to his house and having a barbecue with on Sunday. They love him, that he's just the warmest guy. And
it's about
this,
family.
And I talked to a lot of people during this era. Mm-hmm. Because this is the era, the 1-2 punch of Dead Silence and Death Sentence crippled his career. He was the new hotness, and he had two failures. And critics...
How is Death Sentence a failure? I mean,
critics
how?
Savaged him. Because they're not us, Brian. Because they don't have the Tarantino-like idealism of, hey, if half of this movie is awesome, I'm going to praise that half that's awesome. If half of it isn't, most critics will kick it in the nuts and say, this could have been a good movie, but they don't go, okay, forgive this. This is going to suck. Trust me. You just plug your nose during the family scenes. Plug your ears during when the music comes up, you know, because once you get to the scenes with the villain, just a lot of people don't do that. And to be fair, both of these movies are seriously uneven.
Yeah.
At this point in his career, he really was on the ropes. He, you know, people were not taking him seriously anymore. You know, it was a one-hit thing. People look back, reflected with these films on Saw, and go, oh, this is all you can do. And so I was talking to a bunch of people that knew him at the time, and they all said the same thing. They're like, look, James is just a really great guy that wants to make big-budget action movies. He just wants to make big, expensive, you know, action movies where he can have a lot of fun and throw a lot of stuff at the screen and do some crazy shit that nobody's ever seen before. And so, and it's like, well, it doesn't look like that's going to happen. And everyone's like, I know, and we really want it to, so we're really pulling for him, which is, which was where he was.
And I won't say I'm a friend of his, but I will say, moving into our next film, the reason that I got to know him is because at South by Southwest, back in 2011, I wrote a review of Insidious. And Insidious is a movie that upon further viewings, I have liked more and more. And in that review, what I basically said was there's a lot about this movie that is intensely effective. There's a lot about this movie that works so well for me. And what undoes it is the jump scares and the sound design.
Well, and let's before we get into letting you talk about Insidious, talking about how he was on the ropes. 2007, he's got two movies out. He's got to have something else, right? No, he was, put on that list where, he's coming in second place to a lot of other directors on things. He's just not getting anything off the ground. And along comes Jason Blum. And Jason Blum comes up and says, I think you're really talented. I've seen your movies. I have more faith in you than other people do. I'm going to give you X amount of dollars, and I think it was $900,000, to make whatever movie you want as long as you give me a decent pitch that I like. He pitched Insidious. Blum said, I love it, and got the $900,000, and Juan got final cut, and Juan got to make his movie. Mm-hmm. And that's exactly the exact same deal it made just a little later to Scott Derrickson, going, I'm going to give you X amount of dollars to make this movie. You just bring me a great pitch. And Blum's idea was, I'm going to take these really talented directors that Hollywood has cast aside, that isn't the new hotness right now, that Hollywood had fucked with, chewed up and spit out, and it's Hollywood's fault, but they're going to blame the directors and not going to give them a second chance. I'm going to just let them make their movie and prove it. And James Wan and Scott Derrickson both swang for the fences and said, look, if this is going to be my last movie, I'm going to make it be a movie that I can be fucking proud of. Yeah. And James Wan went on to make Insidious, and all of a sudden, that reignited his career.
And I'm not going to talk too much about Insidious, because I know it's a film that you and I very much differ on our opinions of. But I will say that when I initially saw
it... I'm a little too close to, because, you know, a lot of my good friends and coworkers made that movie. And so it's really not fair for me to talk about it one way or the other.
Well, the thing is, I really liked the concept of the movie. I like how it was mixing a lot of sci-fi concepts into the haunted house genre. And I liked some of the slower, more deliberate scares. The only two things that I really didn't like about Insidious were all of the jump scares and the really, disharmonious violins that would attack you every time there was a scare. And I was just like, you don't need that. And that was my biggest problem, is, like, I don't think those things are necessary, because you were selling such a better movie in your stillness moments. And the moments where we're forced to just look at stuff,
but that's
so much more scary.
But that's actually one of the critics don't like those. And every horror movie that uses them gets knocked for it. Audiences love those.
And I am not, and it's, that's fine, but I'm not, I mean, talking about, well, how audiences react.
Yeah,
I'm
no,
talking
no,
about
no,
how
no.
I reacted to it.
Yeah, so. No, I mean, and the thing is, you know, what you have to keep in mind with these Blumhouse kind of paranormal films is they're roller coaster rides. And that's what they're setting up. And that's, you know, yes, no, you're absolutely right. You know, I agree on the moment on the strings. I think the strings, again, I think Juan's biggest weakness as a director is where he goes with music choice. I think that's always been a thing for him. Occasionally he chooses just the right perfect song. You know, in Dead Silence, he's got just a perfect song moment. And in Death Sentence, there's one song that's just absolutely perfect for the moment. And here, and in Insidious, the song playing on the
Tip-toe
record.
Through the Tulips.
Yeah, yeah. And that version of Tiptoes Through the Tulips is absolutely
super creepy. Yeah.
Yeah. But then the rest of the time, I think that's, as a weakness, that's his greatest weakness.
And I bring this up because this is how I started talking to James Wan, is I posted this review, never thought he would read it. And not only did he read it, he messages me on Facebook and says, like, and basically, like, argues a couple points with me. And I was like, wow, I'm really kind of surprised that you even care, but yeah, let's talk about it. And so we started talking, and then I met him, and even though he knew I was the guy who, it was, again, like a half and half positive negative review, and even though he knew that I was the one who wrote that review, he was still very courteous and like, hey, it's really nice to meet you, we've been talking on Twitter. Like, he's a really nice guy, even to people like me who wrote, it was not a scathing review by any stretch of the imagination. And in fact, in that review, if you go back and find it on Film School Rejects right here, I said that there's a lot about this movie that works so well, and I wish they had just scaled back on the things that don't. And upon further viewings, it's like, okay, yeah, it's still there and it still bugs me a little bit, but the scenes were like, the seance scene with Lin Shaye is so good, and the thing in the corner that just stands there and points still gives me nightmares. Like
the comedy with
Lee Whannell, yeah.
And I forget the actor who plays the, you know, as the two paranormal investigators, they really do kind of spruce up the movie in the best way.
Absolutely. So it, again, it's to me what it is you have an almost right there perfect haunted house movie, and there's just a few bugs to be worked out. And when he works out those bugs, we get The Conjuring. And that brings us to The Conjuring, because The Conjuring is another haunted house movie from James Wan that irons out all of those wrinkles and is so fucking powerful.
Yeah, but also is one of those movies that the studio really believed in and believed in him at that point. What we ended up with was a movie that was made for $20 million, which is his highest budgeted horror film of his entire slate. Like, in the same year, because the Insidious convinced them, and in the same year you get Insidious 2, which is, you know, very low budget. Blumhouse.
A lot of fun, and James Wan does a lot of neat things in that one too.
So. But he's got, in that same year, you get to look at the film that was a Blumhouse level budget, and then you get to look at a $20 million. What can James Wan do with a $20 million budget? Oh, he can make it period, and he can make it creepy as fuck, and can do some weird shit with visual effects that he would not have been able to do in the other films.
Absolutely, and The Conjuring. What I like about The Conjuring, and what's probably going to get me a lot of flack from people who like theatrical horror, is that it scales back on the jump scares, and it works on building atmosphere. And to the point that if you think about the very last shot of that movie with the music box and what we thought was going to happen versus what actually happens, I think is a direct response from Wan of like, okay, you think you know exactly what I'm going to do. You think you know exactly how many jump scares I'm going to use and how I'm going to manipulate you. I'm going to manipulate you by letting you think you know how I'm going to manipulate you. And I think it's so fucking effective.
Yeah, and he has two absolutely brilliant original moments in The Conjuring that it's very hard to get a truly original scare in a horror film, because there's been so many. It's like and in several of his films, including like Dead Silence, he falls back on, you know, the mirror cliche, where it's like, somebody's going to be standing next to a mirror and we're going to watch something walk behind and, oh, turn around and, oh, it's not there. And that is, it's really easy to fall into those tropes. And he does two things. The clapping out of the wardrobe is just creepy as fuck. And then this amazing shot where this sheet flies off in the wind and then covers up the body of a spirit and then flies away. It's just both of those moments. Those were moments where I was just sitting there going, I'm fucking jealous. Where the fuck did those come from? Those are fucking genius. And it was like slow clap moments where it's just like,
you mean like,
yeah, no, yeah, yeah, but I was,
there's your slow clap.
Yeah, no, but I was just like, wow, like both of those moments. So, you know, when you've got a horror movie that rakes in what, like $100 million,
something in the ridiculous summer.
And it was really one of those absurd things, because everybody was like, oh, it's coming out in June, because for the longest time, everyone said, nobody wants horror in June. Nobody wants horror in June.
Nobody wants bad horror ever is the thing. That's the thing that people don't realize is like, if it's good.
Or July. I'm sorry. I said June, July.
If it's good, you can release it whenever you want. And that's the thing is, yes, we're talking about how absurd the amount of money that movie made is. It fucking deserved every dollar that it got. Yeah. I want to make that very clear. This is an absolutely outstanding movie that made me realize that James Wan, and we use the word master during the series, is, if nothing else, the current master of haunted house films. He is doing it like nobody else is doing it, and even in the moments that don't work, whatever, he is still doing interesting things with it, and he is still knocking it out of the park, and the stats do not lie. Like, this guy is the current king of haunted house flicks. And, you know, he's moved on to Furious 7. There's talk about Conjuring 2. I don't know if he's going to do that.
I would imagine he probably wouldn't. Because I think and this is just entirely speculation, but from what I've heard for years and what he wants to do, I imagine he's going to keep picking big action movies, because that's really, because he's done everything he can with horror, really. I mean, he's done, a total of 5 horror movies at this point?
Yeah, I think that's right. But the thing is, he is currently, well, it can change, obviously, a lot of things can change. He is currently attached to The Conjuring 2, which is called The Infield Poltergeist. And of course, The Conjuring is also what introduces us to Annabelle, going back to the whole creepy puppet thing. I should have mentioned during Death Sentence, the face of the Saw doll is on the wall behind that third John Goodman scene. And I'm not. Oh, and in Insidious, it is behind Patrick Wilson. Somebody drew it on his classroom's chalkboard. So it keeps following us around.
You know what's, you know what, another bit of speculation here is Conjuring was Universal, wasn't it?
It was Universal.
I bet that was part of the deal with Furious 7.
You have to do Conjuring 2.
We'll give this to you if you sign to do Conjuring 2. And that he probably will then, you know what, I might be absolutely wrong, and he'll come back and do that because of the Furious 7 thing, and then know that he's free to go off and do anything else. But yeah, no, because the thing is, what I really want to see from James Wan right now is I want to see James Wan, because I've seen him do horror. And the thing is, as I said, you know, with these films, he's borrowed from, even in The Conjuring borrows a couple of bits from Dead Silence.
Including an appearance by the doll from Dead Silence in The Conjuring.
Yes. So I just feel like where he is, he's repeating himself, and I kind of want to watch him do action for 10 years. I want to see what James Wan action movies look like. I want to see when James Wan says, yeah, I really feel like I wasn't able to nail Death Sentence, so I want to do something like, I want to do another revenge film, and I want to make it as bloody and gory as I made Death Sentence, and just make 2 hours of the last 20 minutes of Death Sentence. I'd love to see him do that.
Did you hear about what he wants to do?
No.
Apparently, what he was trying to do for years and what he's looking into maybe doing again, he wants to do MacGyver. He wants to do a MacGyver college years movies, like the origins of MacGyver. So I think you're right. I think he's got his mindset right now is all about action. Like, that's where he wants to be.
I don't know. He may want to make that. I don't know, even with the juice he has, that he's going to be able to make that.
But that's what all I'm saying.
No. Let me finish that thought, because MacGruber kind of it's one of those things like what Daniel Craig talked about with the problems with making coming in and being James Bond, is that with the James Bond movies, Austin Powers fucked James Bond.
Yeah.
Because all of a sudden they could not go with the silliness anymore, because everybody felt like it had, Austin Powers had ruined the silliness of Bond, that you had to be gritty. They had to go back, and they couldn't be funny for a while. And I feel like MacGruber, especially since they're trying very hard to make a MacGruber 2, I think MacGruber may have undercut the whole thing with MacGyver.
Yeah.
Because not just the movie, but you know, the bits on SNL. MacGruber!
Yeah, but that's not really the point I was making. The point I was making is that he's very action-oriented this time.
Yeah.
So I agree. I would like to see him do action for the next 10 years. That does not dissuade me, however, from wanting to see The Conjuring 2 directed by James Wan, because, again, this guy is the master of haunted house films, and I know he would bring something interesting to the table. Speaking of bringing something interesting to the table, Furious 7.
Furious fucking 7.
Motherfuckers. Oh my God! So you've seen this now?
Oh
since,
yes.
Since we last talked, I saw it on
opening night. Yeah,
holy shit.
Yeah, but I went out, grilled steaks, had some New York strips, and it's like, it's man night, baby. Let's have some steak and watch Furious movie, and this comes from somebody I have a very mixed feeling on the Furious movies. I mean, I love them as a series, but. You know, I believe the one true outline of this is, you know, the one true order is, you know, 5-1 until this movie, 5-1-4 3-6-2. And after 6, I loved the first half of part 6, and I hated the second half.
Really?
I did. It got like, I'm fine with it being implausible, but it got so implausible. It got so ridiculous that it just felt like we've run out of semi-plausible, implausible things. Like, now we're just creating runways that are 10 miles long, and we're just, you know, doing really stupid shit. But the really stupid shit wasn't visually impressive enough.
See, I completely disagree with
that.
But that specific point, I think that's what makes the implausibility stuff works, is because it is so visually impressive, and because of the fact that even when it makes that jump, it has established so much of its own, like, these are our rules of physics, that when it makes that jump, it's not a huge leap, it's a tiptoe and a skip from what they were doing before. But I don't think it's that much of an elevated change.
But the characters become implausible as well. And the thing that works about the Fast and Furious series is that through all the good ones, the characters stay really plausible and likable. The best part of part 3, and I know that there's a lot of 3 defenders out there. I have really serious issues with 3. I feel like it's a hipster movement. Like, the hipsters really love 3.
Well, no, I think here's what I honestly think that is that when Justin Lin came in and completely changed the face of that franchise, starting with the 4th one, because he saved that franchise and turned it into what it is now, I think people are lumping in Tokyo Drift with their admiration for what he did, when really he didn't start to do that until the 4th one.
The thing is the one great thing about 3 is Han. And then that's where in the movies it starts getting like implausible, and it's just like, wait, you know, this guy's still alive. He was dead.
They completely explain it's not implausible. No.
Hold on. That's where I was going. And then they wind it around and explain to us by the fifth movie, it's like, oh shit. Because in the fifth movie, they explain how Han shows up. Mm-hmm. And then it's like, oh. And then, you know, the sixth movie is that ticking time bomb and of what happens. And then you have, you know, the end of six, which is the death of Han. And they totally, you know, that moment totally earns it. And you realize that movie seven that's coming is going to be a revenge movie of getting revenge for one of the greatest characters of the fucking series.
All that pontificating from the two of us aside, how fucking awesome was Furious 7?
Oh, Furious 7 is great. My new feeling is that it's the third best of the series. I feel that it is James Wan's best film by far. That it is just, it is gloriously stupid.
But in a way that, again, and this is the difference between, and we were talking about this off mic, the difference between the Fast and Furious movies and the Transformers movies. Even when they go silly, even when they go big, even when they break the laws of physics, we still care about the characters. We still love those characters. And they aren't breaking their own rules. It's like they're breaking the laws of science, but they're not breaking their own rules.
Well, the other thing that I think that's the difference between this and like the Transformers franchise is, you know, you can feel Michael Bay going, hey, look, isn't that cool? Isn't that awesome? Isn't that just kick ass? And the Furious movies are like, isn't this fun?
Yeah.
Aren't you having a good time? Isn't this, you know, that it's why they, you know, every single movie has the stupid fucking series of shots out of a Bud Light commercial where it's like, okay, we're at the car races and here's the quick shot of three butts in thongs or in walking in slow-mo, and here's the shot of, you know,
Fast and Furious. Three butts.
Yeah, every single movie has the fucking three butt shot, and it's let's have some people walking in slow mo and show some ass, and let's show some low cut dresses.
Three butts, too furious.
Every fucking movie, go through them. In fact, you know, it's
well, they have to squeeze. They have to do that because at some point somebody went, remember when these movies were about street racing? And they're like, okay, well, I guess we'll put a street racing scene in this movie.
Well, that's exactly my point, is that every movie calls back to that, and they always make sure that those scenes are fun, and that we show the characters having fun. We see them back in their own element. We acknowledge what's going on with all this stuff. And it's and these movies don't, when these movies, the movies that stop being fun, like what happens in 2, the reason 2 isn't, you know, 2 forgets to be fun, and 2 has this awkward character chemistry, and 2 was admittedly a clusterfuck that was not, it was one of those movies that was destined to suck. Because really what ended up happening was they sat down and wrote a script, and they had the script and they turned it into the studio, and then Vin Diesel pulled out he gave the ultimatum. He's like, I'll come back for $25 million. Knowing they would say no.
Because he wanted to do XXX, right?
Riddick.
That's
he wanted to go off and do Riddick and Chronicles of Riddick. And so they balked at that and said, fuck you. And so he pulled out. And once they pulled out, they were like, once he pulled out, they were like, well, there's no need for,
Michelle Rodriguez.
Michelle Rodriguez. And if we don't have Michelle Rodriguez, why do we have Jordana Brewster?
Yeah.
And okay, go back and quickly rewrite something that uses a lot of this story because we love this story, but brings in another character and still use Paul Walker. And so the movie just kind of just doesn't work, which is why I think it's the worst of the series.
Yeah.
But this movie, talking about seven is everything Juan does well except for the blood and guts, and it is as I said, gloriously stupid, because it has the most ridiculous stunt of the series, which still fucking works,
which again looks like very similar to the one in Death Sentence that we mentioned before. And also,
oh no, that's
wait,
not
what
the
are
stunt
you talking about?
I'm the single most ridiculous thing in that movie is when they take a race car and jump it from building to
that's
building,
right?
That's
yeah.
The single most in fact the my only flaw with the film, my only real problem with the film, is that I think the entire Dubai sequence is unnecessary. I think if you I think if you cut the Dubai sequence from the film, it really feels like we need something to lengthen the movie, because we've already established all of our villains. We've already had them do some amazing stuff, and the Dubai sequence kind of adds, it pads out the movie. Once we've got the character with, you know, who's supposed to have the thumb drive, once we find out we've got to go somewhere else to get the thumb drive, and oh no, I sold your thumb drive. Now you're going to have to go and do this elaborate break-in here. That there's a lot of good to that sequence.
Yeah. But without that, you don't get the Ocean's 11 moment, and it doesn't work. I think you have to have the Dubai sequence. If no other reason than to make sure that every... Because one of the things I liked most about Furious 7 that James Wan did even better, yeah, I'm going to say it, even better than Justin Lin, is he gave each one of those characters a little bit more integralness, I guess, to the overall plot.
Yeah.
Because there's so many like previous movies where it's like, these guys are just here to drive cars. Chris Bridges, alias Ludacris, is given an actual Livingston Dell like character thing, an actual role to play beyond driving a car, and all of those little moments. And without that Dubai sequence, we don't get that, and he would be the one character who isn't given a moment like that. So for me, I think you still have to have the Dubai sequence. Plus, the fucking Dubai sequence, dude. Seriously.
No, there's a lot of good stuff in there. It was just one of those things where plot-wise, it just kind of felt like, this is actually just here to make it longer. Like, because the Dubai sequence never does anything else in the rest of the film, whereas, like, the, you know, the big scene before that, the amazing fucking chase sequence of the bus... and the rescue sequence, that's so amazing, and that sets up all of our fucking villains that then show back up in the ending for this big fucking crazy absurd third act, which is just amazing and is really great. So that's seriously,
can we at least both agree that even a straight men we got a little bit erect when The Rock flexed out of his cast?
Oh no, I love that.
daddy gotta go to work.
It doesn't matter that I shattered my arm what is effectively like 4 days ago.
Now I'm shattering plaster because I'm the fucking Rock.
I'm the Rock.
Oh, I'm sorry, Dwayne Johnson, because 20 publicists died to make him Dwayne Johnson.
I am big Dwayne Johnson.
And let's talk now about why this is full circle. As we mentioned before when we alluded to Saw.
Listen carefully, if you will.
So you remember how we said people didn't think that a horror director could helm a major action franchise like The Fast and the Furious? Cargill, what is the most basic component of Saw's central conceit?
Okay, yeah. I see. I remember what you're talking. Yeah, you're talking about the end of the movie. Like the thing is that this character has been put in a room, chained to a thing, and he has to cut his own leg off.
Exactly. That gimmick, which became the identifier of Saw, was stolen from the end of Mad Max, and James Wan has admitted to this.
Acknowledged it, that they stole it from the end of
Mad Max. Where Max stumbles upon the last surviving member of Toe Cutter's gang, forces him to cuff his ankle to the exhaust pipe of a wrecked car that's about to explode, hands him a hacksaw, and says his only chance to survive is to cut through his own ankle. So how did James Wan end up directing a film in the second greatest car exploitation franchise of all time? By kicking off his career with an homage to the greatest car exploitation franchise of all time, bringing that shit completely full circle. That is James Wan. He is a modern junk food master. He is the master of contemporary haunted house films. This guy can literally do it all.
Yeah. No, he's really fucking talented, and I think if I had to put money down, I would guess the next 15 years of his career are going to be far more interesting than the last 15 years.
Game over.
And that brings us, of course, to our junk food pairing. And for this, you're going to have to walk with me a little bit here, but I think it'll pay off. We're going to go with a ginger dead house. Now, lots of people make gingerbread houses at Christmas, but rarer is the person who makes a ginger dead house for Halloween. This is an edible haunted house that, much like the career of James Wan, can be assembled from a very random assortment of components, be they candy, be they cookies, be they those candy corns as tombstones. All of that stuff can come together and make something really tremendous that, very much like the career of James Wan, is as varied as it is delicious. That's my gingerbread pairing, my junk food pairing, the ginger dead house. Look up, like there's some really elaborate ones online. You should go look it up. These people are really creative. Well, that's going to do it for this week's show. Thank you so much for joining us. And that's also going to do it for this series. I hope you've enjoyed our modern junk food masters. We talked about this. There are so many other filmmakers that we feel qualify that we'll probably do this series again.
Yeah, no, there's a lot of people on the scene. Ty West, the Soska sisters, So many great folks. JT Petty. You know, there's just so many talented people. We could not fit them all into one month, so we literally just kind of went with the first ones that came to our minds. And figured, well, we'll do this again. So if you guys enjoyed this, let us know.
Throw out some suggestions in the comments.
Let us know on Twitter. Let us know in the comment section. Say, here's, you guys need to do an episode on these modern guys, this modern team, this modern director. We will definitely
we're very responsive to our Twitter and Facebook. So definitely keep sending us messages. Keep telling people how much you like the show. We really appreciate that. But yeah, by the way, speaking of Twitter, you can follow us at Junk Food Cinema. You can also like us on Facebook, facebook.com/junkfoodcinema. And of course, iTunes and Stitcher is where you can hear us. Cargill, where can people find you online?
You'll find me at twitter.com @massaworm. That's MASSAWYRM. Or on Facebook, on my Facebook page, facebook.com/massaworm.
You can find me on Twitter @BryGuySalisbury or on Facebook, facebook.com/BryanSalisburyCritic. Or you can find me over at my home away from home, oneofus.net. Lots of great geek podcasts and blogs over there for every geek taste. Definitely check that out. Use those Amazon links that we're going to throw up. Every time you do, no matter if you buy that item, as long as you get to Amazon via that link, we are supported and we really do appreciate it. But I think it's probably time for us to get out of here because the lights keep going on and off and stuff keeps slamming around. And I think we might have a poltergeist.